Everyone, thanks for joining. My name is Toni Rialli, and I'm the Coastal Program Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. So I'd like to introduce our guest speaker today. Her name is Dr. Lynn Carter, and she is the Associate Director of the Southern Climate Impacts Planning Program at Louisiana State University. Dr. Carter also directs the Adaptation Network, which is a nonprofit organization that focuses on building climate-resilient communities. Dr. Carter.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank both ICLE and the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, Missy and Toni, for inviting me to start this series. The first slide, please. I want to say just for a moment a couple of things about the Southern Climate Impacts Planning Program so you all have an idea of this new program that's in this region. It's the ninth NOAA RESA. Right now it's still the newest. There may be more coming. It's shared between LSU and OU, and we're a little bit unique in that we have both the state climatologists from Louisiana and Oklahoma as well as the Southern Regional Climate Center as partners with us. RESA programs are stakeholder-driven research, and we aim to look at regionally relevant research that results in critical information, products, tools, and education, and that would be useful to the states within our region. Our MO is through engagement with partners, decision makers, and other stakeholders. Our region is the largest, actually, of any of the RESAs so far. We have six states. It's the largest because it matches the region of the Southern Regional Climate Center: Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee. I know I say that fast six times, right? Our focus is multi-hazard preparedness, severe storms, droughts, floods, hurricanes, extreme temperatures, and the like, and coastal impacts of climate change and variability. We're working right now with two inland communities, and at some time in the future we'll be looking for a coastal community to partner with to help us to develop products that would be useful to other communities. We've just completed a survey of our regional states to find out their needs, the kinds of issues that they need information on, how do they use information, where do they get it, what way to give it to them is useful. We also plan, though, to be working with groups such as the Southeast Coastal Climate Network and ICLE and others to help us to identify information needs of communities in the region and to get our products out. So with that, I'd like to move on to the topics. I've been asked to give an overview of some of the information and the facets around what I like to call planning to protect. I've divided my presentation into three parts. The first is that climate change is here. The second is climate change will have consequences for the region and the future will be different than the past. And the third is that decisions today can reduce vulnerability through anticipation and action. Next, please. Climate change is here. We are already observing changes. Next, please. We can see that the climate has already changed in numerous ways. We can see increases in global average surface and air temperatures, which is the graphic that's on the slide right now. We can see that there's been widespread melting of snow and ice, rising sea levels, changes in precipitation patterns, northward moving hardiness zones, and northward moving animals. And I'm going to give some examples of each of these things that we've already observed. Next, please. This is an interesting graphic because it shows that, and this is a point that's important, that in the past there have been regionally hot years. Like 1934 was a regionally hot year for the U.S., but it wasn't globally hot. But 98 and 2006 and most of the others now are all global in extent in their increases in temperature. It's not restricted just to us. Next, please. We've observed that the average U.S. temperature over the past 50 years has increased more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit. But I want you to notice this. Look at the graphic. The yellow represents how much. I couldn't get the scale on here, but the yellow represents how much it has changed. So you can see that some places are much lighter and some places much darker. But we are already seeing that we have more frequent days over 90 degrees, and there is an increased frequency and intensity in heat waves and regional drought. Next, please. For this region, it's important to note that the temperature in this region declined, actually, from 1901 to 1970. But since 1970, Southeast temperatures have increased, on average, more than a degree and a half, and the winter temperatures are up closer to 3 degrees. We're witnessing that kind of a change in the freezing days that have actually declined, the number of days per year. 4 to 7 days on average for most of the region since the 1970s. So a lot is happening since the 1970s. There were about 20 fewer days in West Louisiana and 5 fewer days in Middle Florida. This is specific, but also note, it's not always the same everywhere. Next, please. Arctic sea ice extent. We can see the differences between 1979 and 2003, and this graphic shows how quickly the Arctic sea ice is dropping off. Next, please. I'm showing this slide because I think it's really important that people understand that we are actually observing the red line is the observations, and the blue dotted line is the average, the mean of the models. And we're already observing, actually, that sea ice is disappearing faster than the worst-case scenario of the models would have suggested. So it's more rapid than a high emission scenarios projected. Next, please. This is Greenland, and the light pink is showing where the melt was occurring in 1992. The red is showing where the melt was occurring since 2005. There's probably a newer one, but I don't have it. And recent studies are finding that the snow on the top is not balancing the melt that's taking off, so we are approaching a net loss here. Next, please. Yeah, there you go. We've already seen rapidly retreating glaciers. This was 1941 in Muir Inlet in Alaska and 2004. Next, please. We're seeing thawing permafrost. The house, obviously, is the result of thawing permafrost, and you see it in other pictures, too, with, they call them drunken forests, where the forests are crashing in on themselves. But you can see the permafrost temperature has increased. This is very far north, northern Alaska. This is just since 1978. And in some places where it's permafrost wasn't as cold, things are beginning to fall in, because a few degrees can make a huge difference. We've already observed longer ice-free seasons in oceans, lakes, and rivers, and earlier snow melt in lots of places. Next, please. One of the reasons I talked about the ice for us, even though in this region we don't get a lot of snow and ice, because many of the land-based parts of the ice that are melting will impact sea level rise, and that's important for us. But before we get to sea level rise, the numbers, I want to remind people that relative sea level depends on whether the land base is sinking or rising, and that is different in different locations. But sea level rise is due to warming oceans, which we saw because we can see the Arctic ice is melting, but also melting glaciers, land-based ice caps, and ice sheets. You know, warmer water expands when it warms. That's why pots boil over on the stove. But in this particular case, not only do they contribute to sea level rise, but it's possible that they can also contribute to stronger hurricanes and more rainfall. Next, please. Let's look at sea level rise. Sea level has risen on average globally between 4 and 8 inches. But again, it's all relative. If you look at the top of the graph in Galveston, Texas, you can see that the sea level rise there is much more of an upward trend than it is in San Francisco. And Alaska, of course, is a negative trend because the land is still rebounding as it's reacting from the loss of ice from the last ice age. Next, please. Some areas along the Atlantic and Gulf coasts are increasing more than 8 inches, have had increases of more than 8 inches over the past year. The past 50 years. Look at the color and the size of the arrows. You can see that the largest arrows, many of the largest arrows are in this region. And that's due, of course, to a combination of the land sinking as well as the sea level rising. Next, please. And when that happens, then that can help to contribute to eroding areas, and the eroding areas are obviously vulnerable areas for sea level rise and storm surges. Next, please. There's a relationship between the temperature of the ocean where hurricanes form and the strength of hurricanes. And the blue line here is the observed sea surface temperature in that part of the ocean. And the green line is a combination. It's called the power dissipation index. And it combines the frequency, the intensity, and the duration of North Atlantic hurricanes. It's pretty obvious that there's a real relationship there. Hurricane rainfall and wind speeds are likely to increase in response to increased warming in the oceans. And there are model simulations that are suggesting that for every nearly 2 degree Fahrenheit increase in this particular part of the ocean, then that rainfall rates in hurricanes can increase by between 6 and 18%. Next, please. What else have we observed of changes that have happened in the U.S.? Well, let's move on to precipitation. Over the past 50 years, the average annual precipitation in the U.S. has increased about 5%. But there have been really important regional differences, and I want you to notice those. So, using information that is big like averages may or may not be helpful, you know, to you in a particular location. Okay, let's go to the next, please. So what have we seen for local changes in precipitation in this region? These are observed. All the things I've been talking about so far are all observed. It's already happened. This happens to be the 100-year. The average fall precipitation in the southeast has increased. Look at the fall. It's the lower left. It's pretty much blue by about 30% since the early 1900s. Summer and winter precip, those are the ones on the right, have declined by nearly 10% in the eastern part of the region. Southern Florida has experienced a nearly 10% drop in precipitation in spring, summer, and fall. But what's important here is to notice that the percentage of the southeast region in drought has increased over the recent decades. Let's go to the next one. The next one is the drought trends as they've been measured at the ends of summer since 1958. And we can see that this region has more of the browns, which is indicating a trend towards increasing drought, and the hatched areas are the areas that indicate significant trends. Next, please. Another thing about precipitation is that the way we're receiving our precipitation is changing. This graphic shows that there's a greater percentage increase. We've already experienced this. Greater percentage increase in the heavy and high precipitation and high stream flows. You know, there's much less, there's a reduction actually in what I like to call the gentle rains from heaven that, you know, sink in. we're seeing there that there's a relationship between much greater stream flow with this heavy downpours and precipitation. Next, please. This is another way of looking at the increases in heavy downpours. Over the past 50 years, since 1958, heavy downpours have increased about 20% on average in the U.S., but the Northeast and the Midwest have had much greater. In general, precipitation is up about 5%. But what we're seeing is shifting patterns that are showing that wet areas are tending to be getting wetter and dry areas are tending to be getting drier. And these trends are very likely to continue. Next, please. When you combine the temperature changes with precipitation changes, you're very likely to get hardiness zone changes and where plants and animals like to be, particularly plants in this case. We can, if you look at the map with the pink and yellow stripes, the pink represents a change in the hardiness zone of at least one change plus, you know, one change of getting warmer. If you look at the 1990 map, and this is really actually very important to recognize, this all happened only in 16 years. This is a big change in 16 years. Look at Louisiana in the 1990 map. It's almost all Zone 8. Look at Louisiana in the 2006 map. It's halfway Zone 9. These are significant, and they tell us that there are reasons why plants and animals are changing too. They like to be in certain locations under certain conditions. Next, please. We're already seeing marine species shifting northward. This happens to be from Alaska, but it's a demonstration of the fact that we can already see animals are shifting their ranges. Some are going south, but for the majority, they're moving to the north. Let's move on now, please. So my second key message is that climate change will have consequences for the region, and the future will be different than the past. And again, I want to point out that specific local impacts will vary. Next, please. Number of days per year with peak temperatures over 90. We're comparing here. We're looking at what we've experienced between 1961 and 1979 on the left, mostly green, the lower numbers, with projections under high emissions for later in the century. The number of days with the peak temperatures over 90 are expected to rise significantly, especially under the higher emissions scenario. In this projection, actually, by the end of the century, it looks like North Florida could have more than 165 days, nearly 6 months a year over 90. That's up from only 60 days in the 60s and 70s. And these kinds of temperature increases can have consequences for human beings, for health, for drought, for wildfires, for plants, for animals, for lots of things. Next, please. Okay, let's look at the projected frequency of extreme heat. This is also at the end of the century, and it's also from the high emissions scenario. The model runs, the simulations, show how a hot day that's so hot it's currently experienced only once every 20 years or so, by the end of the century under high emissions, could occur every other year or even more frequently by the end of the century under those sorts of conditions. I mean, you can see the southeast, and some parts are quite dark red, but they're all red. So that's a lot more than present. Next, please. And we talked about the way precipitation is coming now, and this is the projected change in precipitation intensity from the 90s average to the 2090s average. the red line is the higher emission scenario and the yellow line is the lower emission scenario. So again, we're seeing that the largest increases in precipitation will occur in the heaviest amounts, and the gentle rains from heaven will get to be fewer and fewer. Next, please. So there is a projected change in North American precipitation. Again, this is the late in the century high emission scenario. For spring, that's the upper left, the climate models agree that the northern areas are likely to get wetter and the southern areas are drier. But the difficulty is knowing exactly where that transition will occur between wetter and drier. The areas that are hatched are areas in which we have the most confidence in the projections. Next, please. Sea level rise. The lower blue boxes are sea level rise projections for the end of the century for three scenarios: low emissions, higher emissions, and then even higher emissions. They're from the IPCC, the gold standard in climate information. But something they don't include is they don't include any of the ice sheet flow information about how much they could add and how much they're melting or moving, because we're really not entirely certain, and they didn't feel confident to be able to say that. We've added, I say we because most of these graphics and information are from the Global Change Climate Impacts in the U.S. document, and I was one of the authors. They've added a second set of estimates on projected sea level rise based just on the relationship between sea level rise and temperature. And you can see that they are significantly higher. And then if you add on top of those areas where the coastal land is sinking, and we have a lot of those areas in the Gulf Coast, then the actual relative sea level rise could be significantly more even than these projections show. Next, please. So what I like to do now is think about, I've talked about the climate drivers, the temperature, the precipitation, and sea level rise. And then we need to ask ourselves the kinds of questions I used to ask my students, then what? So if climate temperature and sea level rise are changing, are there likely to be health impacts where you're located? Might there be more or less, in some cases, weather-related mortalities? Might there be differences in infectious diseases or air quality and respiratory illnesses? What about agriculture? We've already seen that the hardiness zones are moving. Will there be changes in crop yields and irrigation demands? And might people need to be thinking about doing things in somewhat different ways? What about forest impacts? And I actually have a slide of that following. Changes in forest composition, and what kinds of shifts are we likely to see? And how might that relate to health and productivity, and particularly in areas that depend on forestry for a lot of their income? Water resources and impacts. Changes in water supply and water quality and increased competition for water. Those are some of the then what kinds of questions. Impacts on coastal areas. I already showed some areas of erosion. We are already experiencing inundation of coastal lands. And what about the costs or the decisions to defend or move or whatever we might need to do for coastal communities? And then there are species in natural areas, and it's very likely we're already seeing, I showed some fisheries, shifts in ecological zones and changes in habitats and species. So let's move on to a few of these thoughts. This is a projected shifts in forest types from the recent past to near the end of the century, and you can see that on the left in Georgia, there's a lot more loblolly shortleaf pine, whereas that will likely change to oak and pine. And the you can pick out any of these that are of interest to you, but you can see that they're clearly changes are projected. And some are pretty major, significant changes. Next, please. We've already experienced this. The projections are for probably more droughts in the region. We're already in an increasing drought trend. There might be tipping points or indicators and decision points that you might want to start considering, you know, before the next water crisis in lots of areas. Next, please. We've experienced this loss of 217 square miles of land and wetlands just in 1 year to a couple of hurricanes. Looking at what we now think could happen, we might want to begin looking at options and working with an understanding that the conditions are changing, so our responses may need to also change. We probably can't keep doing the same things in the same ways. Next, please. In some cases, floods are likely to increase with heavy downpours, and we know where our weak spots are. We might want to plan to do something different in those locations. You know, if the scenarios are suggesting that these problems are likely to become more frequent in places where you are. Next, please. The Gulf Coast has a whole region, actually, of roads that an area that could be at risk from sea level rise. The blue in this graphic is below 4 feet of sea level rise. And I talked about this a moment ago, that in the next 50 to 100 years, it could be possible that we would have 4 feet of sea level rise in this region. And if that's the case, there are hundreds of billions of dollars potentially at risk. There are 2,400 miles of major roadways could be inundated. 24% of the interstate highways and 28% of the secondary roads are less than 4 feet in elevation. There's 246 miles of freight lines could be subject to permanent flooding. This region has 6 of the top 10 freight gateways, and they could be threatened by sea level rise. This region has 7 of the 10 largest ports, and 2/3 of the U.S. oil imports go through this region and its ports. Next, please. And what's really interesting to me when I was looking at this area is that there would be a lot more than just a regional problem. And we experienced that after the hurricanes and problems with getting oil and gas. So, you know, this is a really critically important region. Next, please. So while all of these physical changes have been taking place and are projected, social changes have also been taking place. And the change in the coastal county population from 1970 to 2000 is an increase of 38 million people. And Florida has increased close to 9. And, of course, this was 10 years ago, so I'll be interested to see what the new census says. And Texas, 3.2 million more people in coastal counties. Next, please. And the coastal population from North Carolina to Texas, in 1950, it was 10.2 million. In 2006, it's almost 35 million. That's, you know, a 250% increase. Florida has half of that. 3 out of the 10 most populous areas in the U.S. are located here. And how many of these coastal regions could handle a loss of 50% of their population as New Orleans experienced after Katrina? The graphic here shows hurricane strikes during that same period where the coastal population has increased so dramatically. Next, please. many of those folks have now live in some pretty vulnerable areas, and this graphic shows areas in Florida that could be subject to inundation with a 1 meter or 3 foot sea level rise. Next, please. If you combine populations and vulnerable locations, you can see that some of the infrastructure that's critical could also be at risk. And this is just a picture of Florida energy infrastructure. And part of the at risk would be from sea level rise and storm impacts. Part of it's because delivery of petroleum for some of these power plants comes by barge. And because we've already seen that there have been major issues in recovery from recent major storms in these kinds of facilities. Next, please. Going to key message 3, decisions today can reduce your vulnerability, our vulnerability, through anticipation and action. Next, please. There are basically two responses to a changing climate that I've just described. The first is mitigation, and that's where we reduce emissions, energy efficiency, alternative energies, all those sorts of things. We can do that now, and we can save money, but it won't have impacts on the climate, on climate change, for 50 or 100 years. And because of that, we are in for some change. We have change in the bank, as they say. So adaptation is another response, and that is where we plan ahead, where we incorporate likely future climate states that I just talked about into our regular planning, and we do begin taking action. We can implement adaptation actions now and in the future, and there will be impacts on the community, positive ones, now and in the future. Next, please. Of course, there is a third option, but we won't talk about that because, anyway, let's go on. But when communities are thinking about how they might need to consider adapting, it's important for everyone to realize, and even those of us who are into climate change adaptation, that climate change is not the only challenge for you to be juggled. Next, please. Communities actually have a lot to lose from climate impacts. There's sea level rise, storms, water issues, health impacts, forest fires, all those kinds of things that we've mentioned and that I couldn't even begin to mention, but you can think about yourself. Things that you're already having problems with, you can think about, are they likely to get better or worse with the changes that are likely coming. But you also have limited resources and tight budgets and competition, you know, between and among taking care of the elderly, dealing with the economy, the energy, environment. But you also have a lot to gain from opportunities. There's economic development with green jobs and new green energies. There are energy savings, and there can be avoided costs. Communities also have relevant authorities. You have building and development permits authority. You can influence land use. If you know there's a location that has had many repetitive losses from floods or whatever, you can try and steer building away from there, or you can implement building codes that will reduce the impacts when things do happen. You have public transit authority. You can try and encourage people to ride the bus so that you reduce your emissions. There are lots of things that communities have and that they can do. And one of the most important ones is an opportunity to learn from and work with other communities. I know that there are sea level rise projects going on in numerous communities, and I saw that Gwen was on the phone. She came and spoke for me in a conference for Cape Cod communities because Maryland is doing some really good things. We can learn from what others are doing. Next, please. But in adaptation, it's a little bit different than mitigation. Oh, go back. Thank you. It's a little bit different than mitigation. There are no top 10 adaptation actions that everybody can do because adaptations are location and issue specific. If you don't have the problem, then you don't have to do the adaptation. Adaptive capacity is also uneven within and across society. Some of it has to do with resources. Resources can be money. It also can be information. Do you have access to information? Do you have expertise that can help you to apply that information? What about political will? Political will is really critical in making changes. It's hard to make change. Do you have stringent policies and regulations about, say, water use, or do you have flexible water use policies that can be triggered into a different stage or a different step on a different path if you see a trend that's beginning to emerge? And even if you have all the information and so forth, it still doesn't automatically translate into reduced vulnerability. You still have to make some decisions and make choices and make things change. Another thing about adaptation that's really critical is that the scale of the information must match the scale of the issue. And what I mean by that is, I know I mentioned numerous times that, say, on average, U.S. precipitation has increased by 5%. That doesn't really mean anything, frankly, to anyone who has to make a decision, any water municipal water utility. What will make a difference to a municipal water utility might be if you could look on the maps and see in the locations, not the average number, but are you in the drought group or are you in the decreasing drought group, increasing drought group? Are you in an area where you're getting much more of your rain and heavy downpours or not? Those are the kinds of things that I mean, that the scale of the information must match the scale of the issue that you have to make a decision about. And that's one of the things, actually, that we at SCIP are starting to try and work on for our region, and that is trying to see what kinds of downscaled information can be made available to people so that you have a better match of the scale of the issue and the scale of the information. Also, when you're making decisions about adaptation, it's rarely only because of climate change. The only places that climate change is a major driver at this point is in Alaska, but it's going to become more and more of a driver. You have multiple stressors that you need to think about, and hazard management. And hazard management, in some cases, is a good way to begin thinking about climate change. I think I mentioned you could look at the places where you already have problems and look at the projections, and are they going to make those problems better or worse? That's one way to begin to really think about it. There are lots of others, but that's one. And climate change is a moving target. It's going to require continuous reassessment. I would suggest, actually, whenever you do a community reassessment, some communities do 10-year plans or 20-year plans. You also include looking at the newest projections of climate to make sure that you're still on track with the adaptations that you're planning or that you're looking at. Next, please. Adaptation can actually help. This is from the IPCC, the gold standard in climate, where they talk about if we have a stationary climate, then a stationary coping range is okay too. But in this case, where we have a changing climate, if we can implement adaptations, then we can raise our coping range to deal with a much wider range of vulnerabilities. Next, please. This is just an example that they have chosen to identify, that adaptations seem to reduce the numbers of people. If we just choose the same way to protect people from coastal storms and surges, we, by the end of the century, are likely to have 250 million people at risk. But if we change the way we do things, then the numbers of people that will be at risk will greatly reduce. Next, please. One of the things I mentioned was that we can learn from each other about how you might respond to some of your issues. So I'm just going to quickly go through a number of adaptation examples. Responding to sea level rise and storm surge, there are essentially three ways that we can respond. We can protect, we can accommodate, we can retreat. Protecting means really building hard structures like levees and dikes, but there is a backside to that, and that is that we can actually increase future risks because levees and dikes tend to shut off fresh water, so they destroy wetlands, and that also creates a false sense of security, and there's a lot of development then in an area that could become vulnerable. We can accommodate rising sea level by elevating roads, buildings, facilities, improving flood control structures, and enhancing wetlands. Or we can plan retreat. We can have planned retreat setbacks and evacuation planning so that we can accommodate the inland movement of the land, of the wetlands. Next, please. This is a protect example. It's a New Orleans levee, but you can see there are lots of building right behind it. Next, please. This is an example, actually, of a raised sewage treatment plant in Boston. Now, they did this in the middle 80s. They knew that sea level was rising. They took the best projections that there were at the time for sea level rise for the duration and life of the plant, and they raised the island almost 2 feet higher. Another thing that was interesting in this is that they assessed what would be easily and inexpensively changed later versus those things that would be more difficult and more expensive to change later. So they did the thing that would cost even more later. They did it first. So they increased the plant's height. That was a critical thing. But they'll build protective barriers when they're needed. And you don't have to do everything at once. Next. These are a couple of examples of roads. One is on a U.S.-affiliated island. This one is actually in response to projected climate change. They've placed the roadway higher to account for sea level rise, and they've improved the drainage. Another one, not directly related to sea level rise, but the same effect, is elevating Highway 1 above the 500-year flood level and building a higher bridge over Bayou LaForche. Next, please. And then retreat. The retreat helps to preserve coastal wetlands. They're often called rolling easements. There are many states that allow development near the shore, but they don't allow armoring. The setbacks are based on erosion rates, and the structures have to be small and removable. And this is a way of letting the wetlands move because they need to in order to remain viable. Next, please. Heat waves. Heat waves are likely to be more of an issue as I showed you the projections. So some of the things people are doing now, this is more of a hazard reduction. They're having local weather services issue heat alerts on the TV and the radio, providing tips on how vulnerable people can protect themselves. Philadelphia, I think, is using a buddy system to check on elderly residents with the post office. Lots of things like that you can do at the time, but the last one here is installing reflective or green roofing and planting trees in urban areas to help cool the urban island is something that you can do ahead of time. And this is actually something that Chicago is doing. And you can see by the graphic that the roof that's green is significantly cooler than the roof that is not. Next, please. Improving air quality. There's a relationship between warmer temperatures, and they're likely to occur here, and air quality. So there are things that people are doing now, encouraging people to refuel vehicles after dark, encouraging mass transit in Rhode Island on bad air quality alert days, buses are free, conserving energy and all kinds of things that they are suggesting to reduce the emissions on those very hot days. Next, please. For agriculture, people are beginning to think about switching to plant species that mature earlier or are more resistant to heat and drought, altering planting dates. In some locations, they're getting two crops now because they can plant so much earlier and later. But you might need to increase crop and livestock diversity and find a way to minimize irrigation needs. Fires are likely to become more of an issue in places that perhaps they haven't been an issue in the past. And some of the things that people are suggesting and that are being done, thinning trees and bushes near structures, changing the materials that buildings are made out of, and not allowing buildings in certain slope areas because the fire moves right up the slope quicker, and developing emergency plans and evacuation procedures. Next, please. And water issues. Water issues can begin adaptation before there's even a serious problem, and by increasing public awareness and encouraging water conservation and fixing water distribution systems to minimize leaks, and increasing freshwater storage capacity. And Colorado has just changed their law, so people now can have private storage capacity that they can take the water that's coming off of their roof or collect it in other ways. That there was a law in Colorado, you couldn't do that. And in some of the places like where this picture came from, the islands, they're exploring alternative sources. They have had to import water and desalinate and so forth. And unmanaged ecosystems, some of the adaptation examples, you need to establish baselines for ecosystems in their services and identify thresholds and monitor for changes so that you know when things are beginning to happen. You might need to restore an ecosystem that has been adversely affected in the past, because healthy ecosystems can resist perturbations more than stressed ones. It might be important to identify refuges that would be relatively unaffected by climate change, and that's where you would preserve the land, and not land that might be inundated in a short while. And in some cases, you might need to relocate species to areas where there are favorable conditions, where they can live and exist in the future, because they can't get around our cities and things. We might need to help them. Next, please. And adaptation planning can occur in many time frames, and it could be, you know, as short as annual crops and as long as 100 years for the duration of a bridge, or like the sewage treatment plant in Boston was 60 years. So think about adaptation planning in all different stages of projects and programs. And some would be for long terms, but some would be for short terms. Next. So we have a choice. We can think about things. We can anticipate and plan and act, or we can just continue to sort of react when things come. I like to think of adaptation as just better planning. That's my mantra. It's just better planning. So, the next, please. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted. Please contact me. These are the two websites for the Southern Climate Center and for the Adaptation Network. Look under resources. We have a newsletter we put out periodically. If any of you would like to be part of it, then just let me know.